Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight we've got a real pleasure returning to the podcast is my good friend, Mr. David Dean Barrett, who we heard from last year. David kindly came on the podcast to talk about his book, 140 Days to Hiroshima, and the dropping of the two atomic bombs. And tonight we're going to be discussing a different theatre of war altogether, the air war over Europe, fought by the American 8th Air Force, who fought day raids over Germany alongside the RAF, the British Royal Air Force, that flew by night. And we're going to talk about the strategic rationale of the US Air Force, and a number of the key questions besides. Without further ado, let's go to David now and start this evening's conversation.
Okay. So, welcome once again to the Explaining History podcast. David Dean Barrett, who's been very kind enough to come back to us. You might recall David and myself talking over a couple of podcasts last year about the final days of the Japanese Empire and the decision making of the Truman administration on the dropping of the two atomic bombs. We're moving theatres now. We're looking at the US 8th Air Force in Europe and its missions from England over occupied Europe, and particularly obviously the strategic bombing of Germany. Welcome, David. And I think that the first thing I'm kind of curious about is really what was the American American military's view of air power? What, because every country has something they're trying to achieve with aircraft. What was America trying to achieve?
Well, it was really a three-part strategy. The first part of it was that they wanted to do everything they could to destroy German war industry. And in the United States, they decided that the way that they were going to go about doing that was by daylight attacks against specific military targets. Now, clearly in the time frame of World War II, we didn't have anything close to the accuracy that American air power can deliver today. But it still meant that bomber formations were attacking specific in war industry, whether that was synthetic oil, whether that was coal, whether that was ball bearings factory, whether it was aircraft factories where they manufactured, obviously, German warplanes, etc. They were going to attack those kinds of German facilities that were producing war material. So that was the first aim of, we'll say, strategic air power. The second aim was that they also wanted to, and this developed probably in the latter part of 43 and certainly by the beginning of 1944, in advance of the D-Day invasion, they wanted to wrest control of the skies over Europe from the Luftwaffe, because the belief was that absent having air superiority over the beaches of Normandy at the time of the invasion, that the invasion likely would not be able to be successful. And so beginning, in early 1944, the United States essentially under General Doolittle changed its strategy from protecting the bombers that were still flying these missions to destroy a German war industry, to releasing them to go after the Luftwaffe and sweep them from the sky by the time of the Normandy invasion. The third was the heavy use of, we'll say, tactical air power, not that the strategic bombing campaign against German war industry stopped, but after the Normandy invasion, it was the use of tactical air power, P-51s, P-47s in particular, P-39s, et cetera, not only going after whatever remaining Luftwaffe there still were, but going down onto the ground and going after Wehrmacht targets, also railroads, bridges, anything that was helping the Wehrmacht to continue to fight the battle. And so what you saw starting to happen was Wehrmacht divisions having to deploy much further away from the front, delaying them from the front, their armor having to travel only at night because the skies were constantly being controlled to a very large degree by Allied air power, certainly heavily from the 8th Air Force. So those would be the three major elements of American war power, the 8th Air Force, in terms of its objectives during World War II.
So in a way, a lot of what you're talking about is the kind of the prelude to the Allied invasion of Normandy, the depletion of the German war machine, the destruction of infrastructure, the destruction of its ability to produce more aircraft, and the depletion of the Luftwaffe. Now, there's an ongoing debate, really, from the Casablanca conference between Churchill and Roosevelt about, A, whether a Normandy invasion is desirable. And if it is, and Churchill really has to have his arm twisted on this one, he has long and happy memories of amphibious landings in the First World War that he's, has great regrets over. But he... when he kind of agrees that, so we will do this, titanic clash against the Germans in northern France, the date that Churchill wants it to happen keeps getting shoved back and back. And so he wants, the last moment that Churchill really has influence over Roosevelt is at Casablanca, which says, well, let's do the Mediterranean first. And Roosevelt and... his advisors at the time basically say, well, the British have been fighting for quite a while. They seem to know what they're doing, and we'll go along with that. So the interesting thing for me is you've got the 8th Air Force depleting German abilities a lot on the ground from the air and smashing, just destroying German infrastructure, knowing that the end goal is to be able to have a land invasion across Channel, land invasion of France. So the Americans, I suspect, were probably biding their time with the British, thinking, they will get their finger out eventually. Do you get a sense of that?
Actually, there were some, obviously, I think including Marshall, among the American military leaders who wanted to invade in 43 and felt like they were probably capable of invading in 43. Churchill, as you pointed out, was probably to some degree, at least by American view, dragging his feet. The other thing that I think did influence Churchill was the tragedy of Dieppe, which was by far and away much, much, much smaller heavily Canadian and some British. Mm-hmm. And if I recall correctly, only around 10,000 soldiers actually participated in that. But it was not well planned, and the size of the force was so small that it was completely unsuccessful. And I think they suffered, I think it was well over 50% casualties.
Yes, it was enormous. They did learn that you can't drive a tank up a shale beach. That was the one thing they learned about that.
Right. So he obviously had been scarred by that experience, meaning Churchill as well, and felt like the invasion had to be much bigger, much more powerful than anything like that if it was going to succeed. But I think, a counter argument, I guess, to that, obviously it didn't win the day, was that the longer you waited to do the invasion, the stronger the German defenses would be by the time we do invade. Mm-hmm. The other factor in it was, and this wasn't so much coming from the Americans, albeit I'm sure both the Americans and the British would have agreed, that they needed to keep the Soviet Union in the war.
Yeah.
And so the other voice, so to speak, that was being heard in this argument was Stalin, who had been demanding a second front for quite some time, because the Russians were fighting 80%+ of the Wehrmacht on the Eastern Front. And so they desperately wanted another front. Now, Stalin never recognized the contribution that the air war was making, I don't believe, anyway, in Europe, and the forces that it was, German forces, that it was drawing back into continental Europe to defend German positions throughout Europe, and in particular, Germany itself. Mm. Huge numbers of artillery, including the feared 88, all kinds of other anti-aircraft, huge amounts of other, we'll say, war-related materials like cement, to build various kinds of fortifications in the east, and clearly huge numbers of Luftwaffe pilots. In fact, the best Luftwaffe pilots were all being drawn into continental Europe to fight against the combined Anglo-American air power that was constantly attacking day and night the Germans. And so he never really got a whole lot of credit for that. But to answer your question, anyway, finally, it was a combination, I'd say, of Stalin's voice and finally the Americans saying, you know, we're going to do this. We've got to do this. And the other thing I think was that, despite the fact that obviously there was still terrible, terrible destruction of Europe and European cities as a result of air power, if they had simply relied endlessly on air power to do it, the destruction would have been probably even worse.
Yes.
Would have been had we not finally invaded Europe and forced the Germans to fight us, at least in some places, away from the cities, not always, but some places.
Well, one of the defining narratives for Great Britain of the Second World War is the Blitz, after the Battle of Britain, the bombing of British cities. This sort of period of defiance, and this is how kind of British people sort of tend to imagine themselves to the world. But when you look at, oh, it's my son. No, I haven't. I'll be with you in a little bit. Sorry, listeners. A bit of the real world there for you. If you look at the devastation wrought on Germany. And this is where the convenient historical memory doesn't really work. It is infinitely, infinitely greater. The destruction of German cities was and Japanese cities at the end of the war, but was I think a city that experienced 50% destruction was doing quite well.
Right.
And the aerial photos at the end of the war of places like Cologne and Berlin are just kind of haunting, really.
They are.
One thing I guess I'm curious about is by 1943, the combined bombing offensive has begun, where American, the 8th Air Force is flying by day and the Royal Air Force is flying by night. Do you get a sense that there was close coordination between the two air forces in terms of targets, or was there a degree of rivalry? What's your sense of that?
My sense is that there was probably very little coordination by that point in time. I think the U.S. by 43, despite the fact that 43 is really the first year where the United States starts experiencing really large losses on these bombing missions, that nevertheless, they've convinced themselves that they're going to stick with, strategic bombing of German war industry during the day. Up until really 43, obviously the British were still trying to convince, Bomber Harris was still trying to convince Acre at that point in time that they should join the British in nighttime raids against Germany. And to a large degree, my take on that was that his belief, Bomber Harris, this is sort of contrasting the two, was that they could ultimately defeat Germany, break their will as a people to fight by literally targeting not military targets, but civilian targets. Mm-hmm. In other words, they would simply bomb cities in Germany at night. Primary reason for switching to that was they'd started off earlier in the war doing some daylight, suffered terrible losses, and decided to do nighttime raids instead. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, the argument was that they were going to destroy Germany's will to fight. Mm-hmm. Well, that proved to be unsuccessful throughout the entire duration of the war. I mean, yeah. Hitler literally had control still of Germany right up until the time in the bunker that he decided to commit suicide.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Failed to do that. The Americans had convinced themselves by 43, going back to your question, that they were going to stick with strategic bombing, and they believed that they could eventually win this war of attrition. Mm-hmm. The key, ultimately, I think, probably to the American success, and it was something that the British never addressed, and I guess to some degree, as long as you were doing nighttime raids, it wasn't nearly as necessary, but they didn't really use fighters to escort these bomber formations. The Americans, by contrast, were doing that from the very, very beginning.
Right.
The very earliest raids in August were actually escorted by Spitfires.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I think it was in 43, if I'm remembering correctly, the primary escort for the United States had evolved to the P-47 Thunderbolt, mm-hmm. which is a powerful plane, and actually in some respects superior to a number of the Luftwaffe fighters, in fact, faster, dived, more capable, and certainly with its 850 caliber machine guns was an incredibly powerful plane. But nevertheless, all that big power and weight came at a price, i.e. range. Mm-hmm. And the missions were getting deeper and deeper into Germany. And what the Luftwaffe figured out very quickly was the Thunderbolts couldn't escort them. So the entire length of the mission. So they would simply wait until the Thunderbolts peeled off and went back to England. Mm-hmm. And then they would attack the bomber streams, creating huge amounts of damage. That didn't finally get resolved until the introduction of the P-51 Mustang very late in 43. Early in 44, when they started arriving in large numbers, which, by the way, was an incredible, cooperation, I guess we'll say, in terms of airframe, American, and engine, Rolls-Royce Merlin, British. Mm-hmm. When they married those two things together, because the Mustang had actually been around for a little while.
Yeah.
When they married those two things together, that became the best fighter in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And it allowed aggressive American pilots to just wreak havoc on the Luftwaffe.
Yeah, and it had a polystyrene fuel tank underneath that could give it additional
drop tanks. Yeah, that's correct.
Additional flight time.
Yeah, they did start introducing those, by the way, on the 47s and even the 39s drop tank, but they still did not have the range of the 51. No. The 51 could escort all the way to Berlin and back.
Yeah, I mean one of the great problems that the Luftwaffe faced during the Battle of Britain was flight time. And once the British figured out, you know, well, all we need to do is waste the Messerschmitt's time in the air for long enough, and then they'll have to peel off and go home, and then we'll shoot the bombers down. It was
about 20 minutes over England.
Yeah, very little at all. And not wanting to get sidetracked there too much, but the Luftwaffe wasn't ever really designed for the kind of bombing campaign that all of a sudden Hitler decided that they would give a try. You know, these were battlefield aircraft, strategic light bombers, not the kinds of big 4-engine monsters that the British and the Americans built. Which again, that shows you that the long view, because things like the B-17 and the Lancaster were dreamed up before the outbreak of hostilities. These are creations of the late 1930s, and it shows that the long view in Britain and America is that to prevent something like the trenches of the First World War happening again, you would create these giant machines which would fly over the battlefield and take the fight directly to the enemy.
Yes. Actually, you do bring up, if you let me mention something real quick. So you asked me at the beginning of this, or what was the American strategy in terms of the 8th Air Force? And I gave you the three things that I felt as though was what the Americans were attempting to achieve. But one of the things that I would also add to that, to the degree, kind of corresponding to what you just said here a moment ago, is the United States and the UK came up with these 4-engine bombers, as you said, in the late 30s. However, by the time of the outbreak of war, and we'll just talk, because that's the focus of our conversation today, about the 8th Air Force. The reality of it was that while they had these weapons, they really didn't know exactly how they should be used in war. And so a part of the ramp up was not only is this incredible buildup by the United States from virtually nothing, because the 8th Air Force didn't even exist other than on paper at the outbreak of when the United States entered the war. But you also had to take these new weapons and really learn how to use them in war. You know, in the very early days, for instance, of the bombing campaign, or the first mission was flown by the Americans, bombing mission, in August of 1942, against some rail facilities, basically, in France. There were only 12 bombers. Well, in the early days of those bombing missions, there wasn't what we refer to as the box formation that eventually became very popular, that was flown by the United States to maximize the use of all their 50 caliber machine guns in terms of a defensive formation. And also by creating this box, make it more difficult for Luftwaffe fighters to penetrate the box and shoot down, obviously, American bombers. All of that had to be learned. Curtis LeMay, for instance, is the guy that introduced that box formation. He also said that once we begin our bombing run over the target, or ordered, maybe I should say, that the bomber formation is going to stay in formation and go across the target. This is despite the fact that you have all kinds of flak that you see, obviously, in all these World War II videos, these black puffs of smoke, which are German 88s predominantly, firing rounds up into the sky at the altitude where the bomber stream is, and they explode as shrapnel, blowing holes potentially in these planes. The reason for staying in formation, despite taking that kind of flak, is you're not going to hit your target if you allow evasive maneuvers by those bombers. And so despite the fact that there's still going to be a lot of collateral damage, they're going to force the bombers to stay over target while they're bombing. After that, they can take evasive maneuvers to get back home. But they're going to stay on target to begin with. And so the point I'm making here is that we had to learn all of it. And it took time to learn all of this. And you're gradually adding more planes all the time to the mix, starting from literally 12 to, by the latter part of the war, having missions of over 2,000 planes at a time. Bombers, that is, escorted by another almost 1,000 fighters.
Yes. And so it's a kind of a, you have vast air armadas by the end of the war.
Yes.
One of the, there's a fantastic book, I recommend it, I've often recommended it to my listeners, by a guy called David Reynolds, who's a British historian who lives in America, called The Long Shadow. And he writes about really the long shadow that the First World War cast over the 20th century. And he said that, you know, the First World War had informed much of what the British thought about the Second World War, but kind of some of the things that the Americans would anticipate about the Second World War. You know, they had a lesser involvement in the First World War, but still people like Roosevelt, who'd been obviously Woodrow Wilson's naval secretary, thought, I don't fancy much of that, thank you very much. And the use of air power, it's fascinating thing David Reynolds is arguing. He said basically that Roosevelt, long before he'd committed to intervention in the Second World War, even long before the outbreak of the Second World War, thought to himself, well, how do you stop a fascist dictator? He says, well, you build 10,000 bombers and either you fly them or you give them to your ally that needs them, and Hitler won't dare. Obviously, this is to kind of slightly misunderstand Hitler, who was quite happy with German cities being razed to the ground, because he thought, well, I shall build the new Berlin here. But it's really interesting when you look at these kind of machines and you think, well, that machine is the product of almost a political idea.
Yes.
Of how we defend democracy, what this machine is for, or how we defeat a fascist. And I really, I think when you look at the, you know, these huge Boeing factories being able to put out a B-17 or a Liberator in something like just under an hour, and that's happening at plant after plant after plant across America, there was ultimately, I mean, it comes down to this one banal fact about war, that fascism can't defeat mass production. Ultimately, which is reassuring, I guess. But one of the great contributions that America brings to the war is its ability to mass produce and to standardize.
Yes. Yes.
And the ability to mass produce pilots as well.
Yes. Now, one of the interesting aspects of that that differs from both the Germans and the Japanese is that the Americans throughout the war would take experienced pilots once they gained combat experience. As I said, starting from scratch, meaning the 8th Air Force, none of their pilots had any combat experience. But one of the things that they started doing relatively early on was taking theater combat pilots, bringing them back to the United States and using them to train new pilots.
Yeah.
The other thing, huge advantage, you just talked about, obviously, the ability of the United States to mass produce. But the other thing, not only could they produce the planes, and they obviously had the manpower to actually get people that wanted to be pilots, but they also had a huge advantage in oil.
Yeah.
The United States, I think the number is something in the neighborhood of 60% of the world's oil during World War II, provided obviously ourselves, obviously helped our allies, the British, as well in that regard. But it meant that we had plenty. Not only do we have a safe place to train our pilots in the United States, but we also had plenty of oil, so we could afford to spend to provide the fuel to those planes to have our guys train substantially before they went over into combat as well. Yes. I think over time that paid very large dividends to our pilots because, again, going back to sort of Germany in the latter stages, one of those elements that we were going after was beginning in especially the first part of 1940 was to sweep the Luftwaffe from the skies. Mm-hmm. Well, the component of part of that, which was the first prong of that, was destroying German war industry. And a huge part of that was destroying oil.
Yeah.
Their ability to produce it, whether it was synthetic or natural, synthetic, the Germans were producing a substantial amount of the oil by converting coal into gas or aviation fuel in this particular case. Because of the impact that the strategic bombing campaign was having on the oil industry in Germany, it meant that, one, engines, before they were even put in planes, were getting less, we'll say, burn-in time to make sure that there weren't any problems with the engine. And secondly, it meant that the pilots that the Luftwaffe could recruit at that point in time were getting fewer and fewer training hours before they were thrust into combat.
Sure. One of the longest running campaigns by both the RAF and the US Air Force. I'm not sure it was the 8th, it might have been another branch of the US Air Force, was the destruction of the Ploesti oil refineries, which is, and once those have gone, that's when Germany has to rely on synthetic oil, which it you know, is a very inefficient way of producing aviation fuel.
Yes.
Well, I think there we shall leave it for now, but I do hope we can return to aviation perhaps at some point later in the year, if that's okay, David.
Absolutely.
It's been an immense pleasure to talk to you again, and I know we had some great feedback from when you were last on the podcast. People really, really
enjoyed it. I'm glad to hear that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And if you have, there is a documentary, isn't there, that people could watch?
Yes, it's called Heroes of the Sky, the Mighty 8th Air Force. It aired in May of 2020 on National Geographic. I do know that you can find it, I believe it was American dollars, $4.99. You can rent it on YouTube. Quite a few of the cable stations, at least in the United States, are still offering it on demand. And so you can just look up that title and it should come up. I was the, I guess in terms of my title, the historical consultant slash producer. I helped a lot in developing really kind of the storyline and the featured five characters in the documentary. It included LeMay, Doolittle, Tibbetts, Eaker, and a guy, a fighter pilot by the name of Preddy. Preddy was, at least during World War II, ultimately one of the most prolific fighter pilots that the United States had. I think he ended up with 27 and a half kills and ultimately died on Christmas Day of 1944 during the Battle of the Bulge, shot down and killed by friendly fire.
Oh, God.
He had just knocked down two more German fighters and was after his third, was going across the battlefield and American anti-aircraft hit his P-51 and severed his femoral artery. He managed to land the plane, but bled to death before they could stop it, unfortunately. So very tragic story.
Very tragic. Very tragic. Well, maybe next time we'll get to talk about Jimmy Stewart.
All right, that'd be fine.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, David. And once again, a real pleasure. And we'll catch you again soon. All the best.
All right.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.